And I'm going to talk about learning the structure of the code of large groups of neurons. And since I tend to forget at the end, this is just a slide to mention in all the names in boldface of people who did the work or contributed to this. And these are the people who gave us money. So I want to talk about the structure of spike trains. And I want to talk about the structure of spiking at fine temporal resolution. Not talking about rates, I want to focus on one, how we should think about very short snippets, mainly because we don't want to make assumptions about the resolution at which we should try and average, or make assumptions about the nature of the noise, or what's important and what's not. And of course, this comes with the headache that, you know, trying to make sense of the structure of the code or this language at this resolution is very painful. So if we just think about, you know, discretizing times into small bins and just asking if a neuron spikes or not, then the number of patterns, even 400 neurons, is too big to do anything useful with any sense of direct force. And so we have to resort to looking for principles or some ideas of how this might be organized. And we'd like to get this to try and get a sense of the code. But until we do, we're kind of stuck to a large extent at this stage, where there's a lot of stuff going on, and there are rules for what's going on. And you're looking for the words that are really kosher. It might take you some time to find ones that you know. So dramatic, and then that's the end of the thing. And then I kill it. Very good.
Very good.
That's it.
Is that kosher, what we did?
It's been a wonderful crowd. Maybe. Good. So some of you found interesting words already. And it's kind of a test, like I figured at some point, which words you actually see. Trying to make sense of the rules of the language is kind of the first step into asking what we all want to know, which is what the words actually mean. So I want to...
Dynamics, information, tuna.
To each his own, Ale. To each his own. In trying to do this, what I want to try and do today is talk about two things. One is trying to make sense of the rules of, you know, what are the words and what are the patterns that you should expect to get. So this is kind of looking at the rules of the vocabulary. And what I want to try and show you is that at every scale that we've looked at in terms of the number of cells, the underlying principles that govern the code seem to be different, which I think at each scale it actually teaches us something new about how the code is organized and how it might be read. And then the other half, I want to talk about how we can actually try and learn what the words mean just by having a small set of them that we think we know what they mean, and then how can we try and learn something about the organization of the space and some kind of a metric on the space of neural patterns, and then a little bit about stimuli. So I'm not sure how much of this we're going to get, given David's talk from yesterday. We'll start and we see how far we go. The starting point is really trying to look for a structure, kind of something that governs how the population does things as a whole. And kind of the obvious one to do is to look at correlations, which everybody's been doing for many, many decades. And that's kind of one example from the retina, which I'm going to talk about at the beginning of the talk. So this is a histogram of correlation values between pairs of neurons in the retina watching a natural movie. And of course, the typical answer that you see in almost any circuit under any conditions that you really care about is that the typical correlations are very, very weak. And that's true also if you look at these so-called confusingly named noise correlations between cells. So this is a busy slide from Ecker et al, who picked a fight with everybody, arguing that their noise correlations were lower than everybody else's. But the bottom line is that was that they argue that when you actually measure them carefully enough over a large enough set of stimuli, you get values of noise correlations which are quite low at the level of typical pairs. Yes.
You could use another word besides noise correlation, and we all used it forever. What would it be?
These are stimulus-dependent correlations. These are not noise. This is the way we describe them, but this is really, really dependent on the stimulus, and I'll show you that actually in a bit. And if you say, well, I don't want to do things necessarily at the level of correlations because they're linear, and I don't want to anchor myself in particular way over the stimuli, I can ask about how much information is carried by, let's say, pairs of cells compared to how much information each of the cells is carrying. So this is an example from Michael Berry's lab in Princeton, again for the retina, but this is kind of a list of people that have seen similar kinds of behaviors in different systems and different stimuli. So in this particular case, every dot is one pair of neurons from an experiment in which the retina was presented. So the retina is on an electrode array, and you can get the spikes of many of the cells. And so as a function of the distance between the cells, you can ask, and the kind of movie that you show the retina in this particular case, you can ask how redundant neurons are. So you basically look at the information that you have about the stimulus from the activity of pairs of neurons, and then you ask how much you get from each of them. And so you can get a number between -1 and 1 that will tell you how redundant the information that they carry, where 1 means that they're completely identical. -1 would say that they're only carrying information as a pair that you cannot see from each of the cells separately. So this would be complete synergy somewhere down here. And what you see is that the typical case, again, is that you have some pairs that are up there, but most of the neurons, even if they're not very far from one another, are kind of very weakly redundant on average, but that these are all very, very low numbers. And so this, of course, for many years has been the common alibi or the support for one of the very few ideas we have in neuroscience about the design principles of the system, and that's a redundancy reduction. And so the idea, of course, that goes back to Barlow from many years ago is that, and Natnev as well, is that because the world has a lot of redundancy in it, and your brain needs to deal with a lot of issues in terms of energy and space and time and heat and all these things, it needs to be efficient, and the efficient thing to do is to get rid of these redundancies and only code things in a very efficient manner. And this is part of the large bottleneck that goes, for example, from the eye to the brain. And so if you actually think of what this would mean, it means that you should expect cells to be very weakly correlated with one another, maybe even decorrelated completely from one another, and this was used to try and predict the shape of, let's say, receptive fields of cells in terms of how things look like. Everybody was happy with that. No, nobody's offended when you suggest their brain is trying to be optimal. So there's two problems with this idea that Barlow himself wrote extensively about in a beautiful paper that's usually missed 40 years after the first one, in which he kind of called this redundancy reduction revisited, in which he, paraphrasing of course, basically said that this was a very interesting idea, but it's problematic for two obvious reasons, or they should be obvious. One is that, you know, this is not something that you want to do if you have noise in the system, and that's something that it's kind of clear that it seems like this is kind of quite prevalent in the brain. And the other is that this redundancy is the thing you use when you're trying to learn from examples. So if you go to a new country, there's all these symbols that you don't know, and you start seeing things repeating, and you see these structures, and this is how we learn from examples, because if things were really, really efficient, it will be completely indistinguishable from noise. So, and it will be very hard to learn the structure there. So redundancy must be there to some extent, because otherwise it will be very hard to learn anything from examples. And so if you go and you look beyond the small groups of cells, and this is the thing we've done quite some time ago now, looking at groups of, this is again the data from the in the lab of Michael Berry at Princeton, looking at the retina responding to a natural movie. So these are 40 cells over time. And we kind of look at discretization of the spiking panels into 20 millisecond bins. So this will be kind of the 10 letter words that we get from these groups of cells. And if you look at the set of patterns or the words that you get, it's clear very when you look at them, this, that assuming that these correlations, which seem to be so weak at the level of pairs, is something you can kind of ignore, it is actually quite kind of a grave mistake, because this is not a good model of what's going on. And if you actually look at the pattern, this is one example of 10 cells responding to this natural movie. Every dot in this plot is one activity pattern of 10 cells. I marked a few of my favorites. And then this is how often you see them in the experiment. This is how often they should appear if the independent model was correct. So ignoring the correlations wasn't that painful. This would be equality here. And you see you make orders of magnitude mistake of assuming that the cells are independent. And this is my favorite one, which is happens once a minute in the experiment. And the independent model predicts it could happen, very, very rarely. So it's clear that something makes even the small groups of cells strongly correlated as a whole. And trying to figure out where this comes from, we went back to an old idea from physics to say, well, if we know something about the cells we're looking at, namely, in this case, the firing rate, and all these seemingly weak pairwise correlations, we can ask, how can we put all of these observations together into the minimum model that will take these into account? And the idea of the maximum entropy distributions is, of course, that because entropy is a unique measure of how much you don't know about distribution, then among all the distributions that obey anything that you would like to measure about your system, the one that has the highest entropy and still obeys these constraints is the one you should go for, because it doesn't make any arbitrary assumptions. And so this, of course, amounts to solving an optimization problem. In which you actually try to find p hat that will capture the distribution of the patterns in the data when you actually have the firing rate of the cells. So you have one parameter for every cell. And if we look at the correlations between cells, one for every pair, and this is just normalized. And this, of course, gives what kind of a very well-known answer for the case of binary representation. So this is what the answer is for this thing. It's an exponential distribution with one parameter for every neuron, one parameter for every pair. Of course, an Ising model in disguise. And what really trying to fit this to the data, it means that you need to look for the right alpha and betas that would either maximize the likelihood of this thing as a whole, or this was kind of amounts to trying to fit to solve this problem. And what's kind of was very encouraging looking at this group of cells is that once you build this model for 10 cells, it basically captures their behavior extremely well. So this is the same data from before. The blue dots are the prediction of the independent model. And this is what the pairwise model, or the Ising model with temperature equal 1 in this case, would do. And the red dots fall on here on the line. And if you're worried about the scatter over here, you really don't need to worry about them, because there's actually an error about how reliable is your estimate with the observed rate over here. So everything here basically falls within the error bars you'd expect just from sampling. And since we've done this quite some time ago, this has been seen in many other systems. And what's kind of encouraging about this is that, of course, this gives a simplifying principle for how the code might be built, because now we need only a quadratic number of parameters to describe what in general would be an exponential number of states that we need to take into account. So then we said, well, what if we wanted to look at larger populations, which we kind of all do. And so this took some time. And this is data that came from the lab of Ronen Segev in Ben-Gurion, in a long and fruitful collaboration. And we kind of looked at, in a similar experiment, again, I'm talking about the retina at the moment, at now each of these dots will be now a binary pattern over 100 cells recorded in response to, in this case, a kind of a white noise movie. And what you see is, again, that this pairwise model is now doing a very, it seems like a great job in capturing the probability of individual patterns at the resolution of, again, of 100 word digits in terms of what's going on in the experiment. And this is over about 2 hours a long movie, which we learned from 1 hour and then compared to the other half of the movie. So this looked great. Then we kind of tried the same thing for other kinds of systems. So this is imaging data from the lab of Hermann Sumbre in Paris. And this is recording from the larva zebrafish, which is immobilized and dreaming about the paramecia that's going to show up soon. And again, if we look at the prediction of the pairwise model compared to the independent model, the independent prediction is in gray. The red dots come from the pairwise model, and this is what we see for individual patterns in this kind of spontaneous activity model. Yes?
So if you have 105 cells, you have 10,000 parameters of fit?
So if you have, you look at all the pairs for 100 cells, it will be 5,000 parameters, yes.
So, how do you
control
the trials? And you, of course, you do better than a model that uses 100 parameters. Yeah? So, how do you control for the added number of parameters that you fit the data, which are better fit?
So, the question is, how well can you predict the new patterns that we haven't seen? So, this is all done for test data, right? I'm learning just from the parameters from any kind of, you gave me the training data that you want to look at, and then I'm trying to predict individual patterns. Many of them actually didn't happen in the first half of the data that we looked at. So the fact that I have more parameters, of course, this is kind of true for any kind of model that you might look at. The key point is, how much better do I predict the appearance of individual patterns? And in this case, and I'll show you in a minute, in even more interesting cases, we can actually capture it in a way which is indistinguishable from doing the experiment again. So it doesn't get any better than that. If you're worried about the number of parameters, I'm happy to talk about this a little bit later, because I think that it's...
Just how many tries, how many data points do you have to fit 5,000?
So how much training data do I need here? Yeah. So this has been done, the examples actually are done using about an hour of training data. But I'll show you later examples when we actually can go down to fractions of minutes to actually try and fit this data for this scale. So we can actually do really well with very little training data. Yes?
This pairwise model captures both the stimulus correlations and the so-called noise correlations, is that right?
So I don't care about the stimulus correlations and noise correlations in terms of that distinction at the moment. I just ask about the observed correlations over the movie. We'll think about this in 5 slides or so. So when we look at the response of the retina to a natural movie, things look a little different. So now this is the same retina now presented with a natural movie. And again, each of these dots is a 100-digit binary pattern. This is the prediction, again, of the independent model. And now some of the patterns that you see up here are off the line of equality. And this seems like a little bit of nitpicking, but these are really troubling because these patterns here are the most common patterns in the experiment. I mean, this one occurs roughly a tenth of the time. This is, of course, the complete silence pattern in this particular set. But we're actually missing things here on the line, whereas before, everything was perfectly on the line. And it becomes even more apparent that something is off when you look at spatial-temporal patterns, not just spatial patterns. So this is now 10 cells over 10 time steps of 20 millisecond bins. And then trying to predict the spatial-temporal pattern, it's clear that, you know, the independent model is really bad, but the pairwise model is not doing that good of a job as before either.
So here pairwise means coupling also.
So we actually are looking at coupling both in time and in space between the cells. And this made us very happy and very worried at the same time. It made us very happy because this means that there's something different about the structure of the code of the retina responding to a natural movie. So there's a special language that is used to actually represent the real world, for a sec. But then it means that we need to come up with a different way to try and describe the rules of that language that actually used for natural stuff. Jason.
So I wanted to what do you mean by natural language?
So we went out in the field with a camera, and we played.
In nature. But
did you have about nature? Yeah.
So did you statistically sort of? Can you explain it statistically what a natural movie is? Like, what have you changed mathematically about the pixels that you're playing?
So we know a lot about the, how that if you look at these natural movies, they're far from the, and there's 1 over F in terms of the structure of the correlations between things, and we can tried everything here also with looking, I don't think I have the slide, but we actually tried looking at the what happens if we take the natural movie and randomize the phases and then go back, and so we retain all the pairwise statistics, and then things look very nicely in terms of capturing the everything with pairwise models as well. So there's something about the fact that, you know, that goes beyond the second order statistics of natural images, if you want to think about it in those terms, that actually governs the fact that the code looks different, or is at least is not captured well with the pairwise model for natural movies.
Excuse me, what is this data from?
Sorry?
This data is from
This is data from the retina watching a natural movie.
Retina of what animal?
So this is a salamander, a retina on an electrode array. We got similar results when we looked at, you know, this was also guinea pig data and fish data and so on.
So one second, Alan. So you're recording spikes here, right? What fraction of the ganglion cell output are you actually recording?
So in that particular area, we get something on the order, I think, of 85% of the cells.
I see. And how many cells are there?
So here we have about 100 cells, so this is a...
I see.
I'm sorry if I missed this, but have you tried P3 before and so on?
Very good. So this actually suggested to us that maybe we need P3 and P4 and so on. But what becomes very clear and painful quite quickly is that if Maoz here was worried about the fact that, you know, for 100 neuron, 5,000 parameters seems like a lot, if you need to take into account triplets and quadruplets, it's clear that for both you lost the simplicity that we were kind of celebrating before. But also, it's clear this is game over in terms of if you actually need to do all the triplets or quadruplets, even for 100 cells, we're dead.
But even for that,
sorry?
What did we learn from the people? Well, so you fit it, it looks red. What did you learn from the parameters of the fit? Do you understand something?
Yeah. I'll tell you. So one issue was to say, well, can we, before we ask what would we learn from the models, is now that we're worried that the model is not doing such a good job, so maybe before I tell you what they mean, we should try and ask what should we do to actually capture this better. And then we noticed something peculiar, which is not very common in the future. We're trying to think of these models in many other places if you were looking at pixels and images or gene expression patterns and other things. If you look at, you take all the patterns that you see in the experiment and you just rank order them according to how often you see them. And this is for the spatial patterns here in purple and the spatial temporal patterns in green. They fall on looks like a rather nice parallel, which in linguists call that kind of a zip distribution. But what's kind of interesting about this is for us is not so much the tail or even the fact that this looks like kind of 1 over F, but there's a kind of this hump over here, which means that there are quite a lot of patterns that occurred often enough that we kind of trust the rate at which we might expect to see them. And so we ask, you know,
what is pattern then?
So we just take all the patterns and we just order them according to how often you see, what's the frequency at which you see them. So these are the most common patterns in the experiment, and these are all the ones that appeared exactly once.
Oh, that's for the white ones?
This is for the natural.
So is it possible to measure the what you're projecting the retina and the retina response? Would you get something different for a white
one? Not very different. And so what's kind of this implied to us is that we can now, instead of trying to look, because we can go for the triplets and quadruplets and so forth, we came up with a kind of a hybrid trick with which we say, well, let's see if we can just use these common patterns to try and get the some selective set of higher order or even just any set of parameters that we need here. And the basic trick here comes from the fact that the neural code is very sparse. So this actually means that because if you have a student that comes from computer science and not from physics, and he will look at 0, 1 and not minus 1 and 1, then it becomes clear that if you are in a place where some patterns occur often enough that you can estimate the the probability very well, then the probability of observing the silence pattern is basically the partition function that nominally you would work very hard to try and get from these kinds of models. The probability of seeing the first neuron spike and all the others silent you can get if you have the partition function, just you can solve for this alpha 1 and so on and so forth. So what we did was to take just the very common patterns, the reliable patterns we call them in this data, and say, can we anchor ourselves just on these patterns and use that to build a kind of a hybrid model. Now that's not going to be a kosher probability distribution anymore because we're not getting all the terms, and this is kind of built in this funny hybrid way. And we asked, well, how far can we go with this with this trick? And the answer is remarkably well. So this is now the same kind of figures from before, only slanted on the side. So let me try and go over them quickly. So every dot here, again, is one pattern in the code word in the experiment. This is how often you see them in the data. And this is the agreement between the model and the data. So log of the ratio of the two. So if the model is doing a good job, everything should be zero here. And this blue funnel here is what you should expect just from sampling. So this is 95% confidence interval terms in terms of how often you actually see things here. So this is the independent model, just for reference again. And you see, again, this is, you know, really bad. The pairwise model is missing all the common patterns. This is, again, all test data. And this is what we get with this reliable interaction model in terms of predicting all the stuff that we kept aside and we were now testing on. And if we, and if we, I'll give you the parameters, don't worry. And if we look at what happened to special tempo patterns, it's doing an even better job, which is completely off the grid. This one is not so good. And again, this reliable interaction model is doing a very good job. And then we ask, well, how many parameters do we actually need? And what's neat about this is that, of course, if you did this thing according to where you stop here, you can just say, well, I can decide to stop here or here or here. You can play with this. And what I've shown you, which is already doing much better than the other models and basically is virtually indistinguishable from doing the experiment again, is actually done with a model in which we can try and ask, what are these parameters? And so these are the pairwise models that we had, the pairwise terms that we ended up having. This is the triplets and this is the quadruplets in this case. And we plot them here overlaid on the location of the cells in the retina. So these are the locations of the ganglion cells. And we put a link between them, and the color of the link tells you something about the strength of the exchange interaction in the Ising model, or the effective coupling between the cells in this case. And so we need a few hundred pairs, a few tens of triplets, and a handful of quadruplets to capture this distribution of 2 to the 100 possible patterns. Yes.
So can you go back to the rank order slide?
Sure.
So here you're saying I'm going to introduce a different type of model that uses the most frequent patterns, and I'm going to fit parameters to that and get a better model.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, another way to have come from that is sort of more very popular in neuroscience right now, to think of a subspace or a manifold. So my question is, the patterns that you end up fitting that are more frequent, do those live in a subspace? Could you have come at it from that direction?
Give me 20 minutes.
Sure.
It was the last slide. How does this relate to the receptive field? So you could think that sometimes that are correlated.
I think I misspoke. These are not the physical location. This is the location of the receptive field with respect to the screen. So this is where the center of the receptive field is. I don't have the size of the receptive field here, but they have some, you know, small overlap between them, but they're mostly kind of.
So if I look at the quadruple interaction, that has nothing to do with the size of the receptive.
No. So, yes.
One question. Is there a rational way in deciding whether to take more triplets instead of quadruplets?
The moment this feels a little bit like cooking, in the sense that, you know, you can ask yourself, well, where do I want to make the cut? One consideration is I want to have as few parameters as possible, for obvious reasons. And the other is to say, well, maybe I should trust myself to take all the things that I can kind of trust to be confident about the value that we see here. So we didn't come up with a very clear way of deciding where we should put the cup. Just at the moment, this is kind of, we can kind of play with it, and this is, you know, the few hundreds is a place where for 100 cells we actually get things pretty well. Okay. So. So this seems like a huge simplification, and it kind of, we can now describe again this very large space with a, something which has come to an order n parameters. But the, something became kind of again obvious that, you know, while this worked very nicely here, it's not clear that we can go further with this. Because if we wanted to go beyond 100 cells, trying to fit these kinds of models for, let's say, 1,000 neurons, bless you, there are several things that become kind of, so these are the reasons why one might worry. So when we went from pairs and then to groups of 10 or 20 and then to about 100, every time the problem, the structure of the code or the principle seemed different. For pairs, it seems like they're kind of independent. For 10 cells, you can do very well with pairwise. With 100 cells, you need to add some small set of high-order terms, and we came up with a nice trick to try and find them, and they'll even get the partition function, which is kind of amusing. But if you think about 1,000 neurons, then we don't know how to scale these kinds of models in any obvious form. One issue that just trying to fit even the pairwise model for 1,000 elements is numerically highly unstable, and it's very complicated and hard. If you take this and simulate it, it doesn't work well. Sorry. The other, which is even more troubling, is that, and this sounds like a stupid Zen riddle, but nothing ever repeats. So even if you look at groups of 200 cells, let's say, no activity pattern at the resolution we're looking at, you'll see it twice. So we cannot use this reliable interaction trick in its simple form again. We can look for some other ways around it, but this is not clear that this is the way to go. And even if we had a good model, it's not clear how we would validate it or check things, except for looking at the thing that actually has high likelihood, which is useful, but not necessarily satisfactory. And another thing which some of you might be too polite to comment about is they say, well, look, this is maybe a very good way, or at least so far it's been a very good way to describe the actual data. But what does this relate to what the brain might actually do?
Just before, yes. Before this bigger question, another conclusion you could derive from your point 2 and 3, that nothing repeats, is that maybe you're being too fine. Mm-hmm. And also, maybe it doesn't make sense to look at the statistics for a huge battery of stimuli.
Yeah.
So why do you think it makes sense to bin it so fine and also to look at statistics for a huge battery of stimuli?
So one issue is that I find it very weird to think that what I cannot easily measure is a place that the system doesn't use. So I can't assume that the fact that it's hard for me to assess what's going on for 1,000 neurons means that I should look at windows of 100 milliseconds and not shorter windows. So this is just in terms of, you know, there's no clear reason why you should pick one value over the other. And
readout,
in terms of
the timescale of the readouts.
Yeah, and in terms of the, even if I don't go to Michael's talk famously, there's very clear cases and examples where the resolution of a few tens of milliseconds is very relevant behaviorally. So I don't see why I should start by saying, well, I mean, it's hard, so I shouldn't do it. So I want to see how far I can push this, despite the fact that this is, I don't see anything once. It's how I see everything exactly once, okay?
So your time scale is 100 milliseconds?
20 milliseconds.
Yeah.
So thinking about this, we figure that, you know, if we want to go thinking about scaling things up, and so one way would to say, well, maybe we're just not, this is not for us to do, to try and describe the structure of the code at this resolution. But we took a different point of view, and this is kind of came from trying to think about how one could generalize it. So we're trying to ask, well, what do we know from the model? It's clear that you need some, it seems like we can do very well for what we've looked so far for with a sparse set of high order terms. So things seem to be kind of within reach, at least it's not clear that what will go much further. And we see, and this is, I haven't shown you, but we have a clear evidence in even in these models and in other places, of course, as well for hierarchical organization. But the other thing is, well, maybe we should, instead of doing, so what we've done so far and what many of us have been doing looking at this code is to go with our fingers. We look at first order statistics, we look at second order, we look at third order, and that's because we were used to doing this and it's served us very well. But maybe we should ask someone who knows how to do this, which is biology. So he said, maybe instead of thinking about the orders of correlations the way we used to think about them, maybe we should ask biology, and biology tells us something about the way neurons listen to one another, which is, seems to be, at least to some degree, random and sparse in terms of its organization. We know that neurons have some non-linear and non-linear function in terms of how they listen to their neighbors, and we know there's a cascade of these similar structures. And the last thing we thought about is say, well, we have another clue, which is the fact that in machine learning it become clear in the last 20 years or so that, you know, if you look at a lot of random linear projections of things, it's a very good way to look at things which are of high dimension but are not as complicated as they might be. And so we thought of maybe trying to put all of these things together, and we like maximum entropy models because it just give a good way to try and compute things. So we said, let's try this out. So instead of looking at any kind of statistic that you can come from home that you might like, we said, well, let's take random functions. Let's just pick a set of groups of neurons in the population and give them random weights. And I'm going to define basically some measurable quantity, or an observable, if you want, for the maximum entropy model, or some statistic macroscopic measure of what's going on here. And I'm going to use a set of these things to try and see how far I can get with these. So we've tried different set of functions. I'm going to show you the one that you all know and love. So this is, will be just simple nonlinear perceptrons. So basically, you want to try and describe the activity of a large groups of neurons. And so the functions will be perceptrons in which you give random weights, which I showed here with the different shades of green. This will be called alpha for every neuron and some threshold for this thing. And so we have some random function that we're going to look at, and I'm going to have a lot of these. And then I'm going to ask, if I wanted to describe the joint activity of the large population, how well will I do if instead of looking at the orders of correlation the usual way, I'll just take these random statistics.
Okay? How do you choose the parameters?
Like this.
From
so we played with random distribution and different skill distributions. It's not very sensitive. So this, you can do a lot of many different things here. They all work roughly the same.
So X is the activity of a neuron, right?
Yes.
So you make a dot product between all your activities and a random vector, and then you threshold this.
Yes.
And you just choose some ensemble for your random vector.
Yes.
Okay.
And I hope for the best.
Okay.
I'm a brave guy, yes. So not only this amounts to saying I need to solve again an optimization problem where I want to do maximum entropy with this set of random functions. Now, at some trivial manner, it's clear that if I have a ton of these, this would work. The reason I'm telling you about this is that you don't need a ton of these. You actually need quite not that big of a number. But this basically amounts in this case to saying if these are the cells, I'm going to have these sets of cliques or random ways of choosing them, and we kind of drew them here in a way that you can actually see the grouping that we get for the 30 of the, our favorite random projections for this one particular population of cells.
Another problem is, how do you get from a linear functions to the distribution?
Sorry, I'm not at the distribution yet. So,
oh, it's not the cell.
So what I want to do is I want to solve this optimization problem. So I'm going to have these observables. And the solution for maximizing the entropy under these random set of statistics will be an exponential distribution where what you're going to have here is basically one parameter for each of these random statistics.
So mu runs over all the choices.
All the, these random functions, yes.
Random vectors. And, but these are sparse?
Yes.
So that's why you get these groups.
So this is an example when we show things are sparse. I'll tell you about the sparseness in a minute.
But you said this is a subset of them, right?
Yeah, because there's... You'll see in a minute we use a lot of them, but I couldn't draw all of them in a way. I mean, there's no way to draw them in this way.
So how many do you have? How many choices? Mu goes up to
very one. Good. So let's see how this world this works. So this is data from Ruzbekiani's lab at NYU that's been and worked at was the PhD of Ori Maoz, who just defended last week, and Gashpat Kachik. from ISTE and Saleh Estiki from Roosberg's lab. And these are examples of two data sets, one from the recording from V1 and V2 with UTA arrays, and this is from recording with the UTA array from the prefrontal cortex. And these are now these different models. Every dot, again, is one activity pattern. In this case, this is over 70 cells. But this is how well, again, how well we predict, how well the models predict the data. So again, everything within the funnel is kosher. This is the independent model. This is the pairwise models. And this is what we get with this random projection models. And the question is, how many of these do we need? So I'll tell you in a second, but just, I got this in the wrong order, but still, just to see that it's doing a good job, in not just in terms of predicting these individual patterns, then we asked, well, what if we went to the largest set of neurons that we can look at, which was about 170 cells. So for 170 cells, of course, no individual pattern will repeat, but we can predict pairwise correlation, triple correlation, and quadruplet correlations in a way which is indistinguishable from the data. And if we look at the for 100 cells at the the 170 cells or so, the distribution of synchrony values. So this is basically doing a histogram of all the patterns that we see in which we have one neuron spiking, two neurons, three neurons, and so on and so forth. This is the real data is in black. This histogram. This is the independent model prediction, and you see again the pairwise model is not good enough, and this random projection model is doing a very good job, which is basically within the error bars of the data here and here. And then comes the issue of...
Sorry, what's population synchrony?
So this is because I cannot look at the individual patterns anymore, I'm asking how well do I capture the probability of seeing a pattern in which you have 70 neurons spiking out of the 178, or 35, or 62, or... So this is basically a way to try and ask, how well do I predict these things?
So what if you sub-select like a group of 100 neurons and then you marginalize your distribution for that?
Very good. So I don't have the slide. We actually do a very good job in predicting this marginal.
But is it better than P3 or P4?
Yeah. And what's really nice about this is that because I'm doing this in picking the statistics, I can scale this very easily. If it seems like I need more projections, I'll just go and buy myself more projections. So this is asking in terms of likelihood over the 170-something cells. Oh, sorry, see, the 70 cells in this case. What's the prediction for the different models? Is the function of the number of projections. So the comparison is the independent model, the pairwise model in green, the something called the K-Ising, which is an Ising model with another set of statistics on the on the averages of the population, which we can talk about later. But basically what we get is that we can play with the number of projections and ask how well do we do with this random projection model or maximum entropy random projection model. And basically, by the time we have roughly the number of pairwise terms that we would have for these cells, we do better with this random projection set. And this is true for the PFC as well, where we need a little more projections, but we actually get there pretty quick. And so what this gave us... So these are the values for these models that don't have a choice of the number of projections. This is kind of comes fixed with or the independent model has n parameters, the pairwise has n squared parameters, the k-Ising has n squared plus n parameters. And
so why are they horizontal?
Because this is they're not, this is just, I could just put a dot here or an arrow, but this is easier to see. So this is, the model is not, this is looking at what happens basically to this random projection model as a function of the number of projections. So these are the values for these other models for comparison. I made a line just so it's easy to compare.
But it's actually not a line.
It's one number.
One number.
They don't depend on the number of projections.
Oh, of course, sorry.
I should have heard that. Sandra.
Have you tried to estimate how the requirements on the number of projections you need scales with the number of neurons you have?
Yes.
And
I'm not going to tell you about this. Because this is a lot of stuff outside of it today. But it scales. So we went as far as we can go, which is with the data that we have, which is about 200 cells, and we do very well with about on the order of 10 or 20,000 projections. But I can extrapolate from below, but I don't know where I need to go if I go to higher values.
It's difficult to increase the number, but you can halve the number.
No, this is all test data. So this is all asking how well do I do on what.
I understand. So yes. There are 100 neurons in a test in yes. your data. And what would happen if you just looked at 50 of them, right? Reduced by a number of, by a factor of 2.
Yeah. Would the, so how would the curve look like? How does it change?
Exactly. Would it go down by a factor of 2? Log 2?
Yeah. So it seems like this is something on the order of log 2, but these are such small numbers that I'm kind of didn't want to go into that particular.
But my real question was so a trivial technical question. I going back, so random projections, are they really random vectors, or there's some sparsity or positivity constraint?
So
another parameter hidden, how many so non-zero components are in your projectors?
Okay, so so I'm actually not going to show you the slide because there was another story I wanted to tell you, but the short answer is that we played a lot with asking how well would this work as a function of the sparsity that you would use here. We didn't want to start by asking things to be sparse, and it seems like there's an optimal sparseness value for the different populations that we look at. So you want to be sparse here. This actually works much better than if you're not sparse. And the number is close to something between 4 and 7 that probably would make Ashok very happy. But,
it's a related question. So maybe I missed it, but besides the sparseness, how do you choose these random, the statistics of these random projections? And another question is, you could take different samples,
yes.
So you would have many such curves, so there should be some fluctuations in the curves, depending, are these averages over
very good. Samples? So these are actually the standard deviations over taking different random projections. So it's basically just give me the right number of projections that we picked here. Again, this in this particular case, this is choosing alphas from a Gaussian distribution with some width that we played with, but it's not that sensitive to
so
that.
Even choice. When you have at the very left, it's one projection or it's
high? No, sorry. This is 1,000. This is 10,000. So this is about 500.
Okay. And so what's the statistics of the
projection? So we try different things from radial Bessel function to perceptrons to other things, and in terms of choosing these alpha values, we tried Gaussian and log normal, and it's not very sensitive. You can do well with many different kinds of distributions here. So we didn't explore this very, very much detailed yet. I mean, there's, of course, issues to be asked about the particular choice of the set, but what I want to try and impress on you, I hope, is that this works really well exactly without really doing this, which we thought was kind of importance.
So why just taking vectors which are zeros and ones? Did you try?
We did. This didn't work as well. It worked kind of well, but not as well.
It seemed like in DFC, there was one that doesn't miss much. Is it dependent on, is this typical for retina, is it also?
No, so this is a V2, this is a PFC. From what we've seen, so we've tried this also on the retina and on M1 data that we had to play with and the other thing. The PFC seems to be more well captured by the pairwise model than the other models. And I think this has a lot to do with the fact that the relations between cells in PFC are much more distributed and diverse.
And what are the conditions, anesthetized?
This is awake behaving animals. So this one is watching moving gratings, and these ones are making a classification task over moving dots in kind of the usual Newsome school of way.
One last question, but what's the scale of the H parameter, H function?
So
what's
this
the
scale, is a,
what's the amplitude? Of the H function.
So this goes between minus 1 and 1.
-1, yeah.
So what this all amounts to, and this is where I'm actually going to, I think I'm going to try and stop with the random projections, because there's another story I want to tell you, and I know there's cookies to be had. But it didn't escape many of you. I'm sure that this kind of random projection model has a very obvious network implementation to it. So in a sense, what we're getting is a shallow neural network, because this is the kind of people we are. We're not deep. And where you make these random choices, and all you need to learn is this set of parameters, And this opens the door to a lot of interesting things, which I'm going to tell you about at a different time, or if you bribe me with beer later, over how you can think about how a real neural network can actually learn to implement these things and would actually learn the likelihood of its own input. So how one neuron here, will, this is the set of neurons that you want to look at. If you look at this set of randomly projecting neurons and you just add up them up, you can actually end up with this basically computing the likelihood of its input or the surprise of what it sees.
So just to be sure, this H was
achieved. So this H, these are the hidden units. They're implemented with a Gaussian, so with a sigma H, which was you can choose any function. But G was just to say that there's a nonlinear function with which you choose them. So I want to switch gear before the cookie time to try and say something. Yes.
The interpretations there. In terms of the shadow network.
Yes.
I
thought I could escape that. Yes.
Escape what?
No, sorry. Okay.
I don't completely understand because you're describing the distribution of the X pattern. So I understand how you're using that readout in terms of the H's. Mm-hmm. In terms of the H layer, but I don't understand how you can how.
So let me try and give you the short version because there's another story I need to tell.
Yeah.
No, after.
So, in a sense, what I'm saying, if I plot this way, not just writing the model, then this is the set of neurons I'm looking at. Then there's the set of random projections that listen to them, and then I have a readout neuron. This readout neuron, if it has the right set of synaptic weights here, will compute exactly the thing that we would have in the exponential from the model. So in a sense, if I wire things this way, what Y is going to do, if I get this correctly, is to compute the log of the likelihood of its inputs up to the partition function. And then, so this is a circuit that would implement this model, and this is something that is kind of easy to think how a neural circuit can basically, in this way, if it knew how to train these in a biological manner, would be able to compute the likelihood of its inputs. So,
and so the point is that given that you're projecting the x's, let's talk after.
There's a whole talk about this, but I just wanted to put this to get the juices flowing and to everybody to bother me later.
Yes. I was just wondering if you don't use random projections, but projections that you get from some method, like maybe sparse coding or something that tries to dig out structure, does that help?
So we can do okay with other kinds of projections that you can choose. We were very happy with the fact that we did this with being completely blind. You can start asking, what if I wanted to be smarter about these kind of projections? And this you could actually do much better with much fewer projections. But there's another talk about this, which I really want to tell you the other story. And there's even the fact that to train these models, you actually need orders of magnitude less data than the usual models, which I can also tell you about later. But there's another story I want to try and give you in 10 minutes. So this is asking, you know, if I have a good model of describing what the population is doing, which I hope I have, yes.
Now if you do that for the retina, can you make contact with the anatomy?
With the anatomy?
Yes.
I wish we had the anatomy.
No, I mean, not the readout, basically the size of the receptor.
Ah, like we haven't
the
looked.
Important projection that, would be,
yeah.
Looks
the we haven't looked, that's a good thing.
How well do these models do for the retina thing?
Very well.
Also well?
Yes, but nobody cares about the retina. Nobody's impressed with the retina, so I had to put the cortical data up.
What's in your next slide?
This is all because of you, you know.
But I appreciate it.
Yeah, okay. So what we'd like to say, if I have a good model for the rules of this language, what can I do? If I want to know what the words mean. And what we all kind of used to do is think about a metric on the spike patterns in terms of trying to look at them. And the most intuitive one is one which is commonly used and very popular and rightfully so. And this is an idea from Jonathan Victor and Keith Rupor from 20 years or so ago, where they said, well, we can actually use what, you know, people in computer science and genetic sequencing alignment do, which is say, well, if you have one spike train and another spike train here, just look for the minimal set of operations you need to do to get from one to the other, and this is computationally tractable and efficient and everything. So you can talk about the cost of moving a spike or the cost of deleting a spike and creating spikes. Or you can think of other, your favorite way of measuring similarity between spike trains, which to a first approximation, I think they're all based on making assumptions about how you should measure things, how things are similar to one another, because we all have very good intuitions, or so we think, about what makes things similar. But the fact that these things look similar, or this is kind of has high overlap, would mean that these two words should have the same meaning because they have 80% overlap, right? Obviously, that's not the way to go. So what we would like to do in terms of trying to see how well we can learn something about the structure of this code book or about the space that David was asking before is to look, hopefully, for some way to get semantics, if we can do such a thing, and not make assumptions about the syntactic rules because I don't know what they are. So in order to do that, we said, well, the way to try and do this, we should actually try and learn this directly from the code. So in order to understand what makes things similar, we need to understand the rules of the encoding and the rules of the noise. So what we did, and this is going back to the retina where we can actually do this experiment, and now we're trying to the same thing on Roosevelt data as well, is to say, let's look at many repeats of the same stimulus and try and figure out the rules of what makes things similar and start building from that. So these are now examples of repeats of, this is a white noise movie that we show the retina. This will be the purple stuff that will be on the left. And the stuff for natural movies will be on the right in the green stuff. And these are going to be a lot, so these are examples of 20 cells responding to the same movie. And we look at what happened here in this particular point in time along the movie. So these are 600 and something repeats of the same movie. And you see this is now all the binary patterns that you got again in this particular point in time in the movie. Sorry. And then you see that these are variations on a theme. There's a lot of, you see structure here, of course, but there's a lot of stuff that appears and disappears, and some things are very reliable and some things are not so reliable. And so in order to try and understand something about what makes patterns similar, it's clear that, you know, the fact that they've been used at the exact same time for the same movie over repeats implies that they probably mean similar things for whoever listens to them. Or at least this is what the retina was trying to say. So we can go and look at these particular patterns and ask, well, for first thing, what can we say about the level of variance between these patterns? So try and estimate the entropy of these distributions. So this is what's commonly known as noise entropy. So and this is now looking over the 10-second snippet of the movie. This is the overall firing rate of the retina in this particular snippet. And this is estimating the entropy for every point in time. We have all these repeats. We're trying to get an estimate of the noise entropy to the best of our ability and trying to correct the way that Alessandro and Stefano taught us how to do. So this is estimate of the noise entropy, which shows you that there are very large variances, a lot of noise at different time, which is really dependent on the kind of stimulus that you show. And if you go and you say, let's try and estimate these so-called noise correlations for different point in time, which is asking how correlated are the cells in this along the movie. So for every snippet in time, I'm looking at 20 millisecond bins again. I'm asking how different is the joint distribution of cells for every point in time compared to assuming that they're conditionally independent, which, because we all know that noise correlations are small, is supposed to be weak. And again, when you look at groups of 20 cells, what you see is that there are times along the movie when the noise correlations are really, really high. So noise correlations are not weak in general. They're just weak on average. And there are particular times along the movie where things are very strongly correlated.
What are the two curves?
Sorry, so this is for an artificial movie. This is for a natural movie.
On each plot, it looks like...
Sorry, this is the variance of this over the different groups of 20 cells. So because we see that there is this strong correlation in terms of response, what we needed is now to build a model for what happens at every point in time in the movie. So we kind of take these ideas from the stimulus-dependent, the maximum entropy models, and try to make them stimulus-dependent. So this is 20 cells. We can do OK with the pairwise model. So we're going to build a model where we know the firing rate, the correlations, and also the PSTH of each of the cells. So this is going to be the values of this and the correlations at every point in time. And so we're going to end up with a model that's now going to have a dependency of alpha for every value of the stimulus, and so there should be an S here as well. And so what this means is that we see that this is doing a much better job of describing what's going on, which is namely, if I look over the time snippet of the movie, this is the firing rate of the retina as a whole, just to give you reference. And this is the log likelihood between this model that we build and the assumption that the cells are conditioning independent, so a collection of LN neurons, and you get, again, orders of magnitude differences between. So why am I showing you this? This is just to say that we have a pretty good model of what the population is doing for every point in time in the movie, which now we're going to use to try and do semantics. So to do this, we're going to use the fact, or to use at least our intuition, about how we should make sense of what words mean. So when you want to try and learn a word in natural language, we learn it from what it comes with, or who are their neighbors or friends. So we basically went and did our version of Amazon's people who like this book also like this book, which goes back to distributional clustering from many years ago, and said, if I wanted to figure out which two neural words are similar to one another, and I don't want to make the assumption of how you should, what's the right metric for these patterns, I should ask the data what makes them similar. So if I could estimate the probability over stimuli for this particular pattern, namely what stimuli it actually points to, or what's the posterior over stimuli if you've seen word two, if these two distributions are overlapping, it means that these words really mean the same thing because they point back to the same set of stimuli. If they're not overlapping, then obviously they mean different things. So we're going to measure the similarity between words based on how they point back to the stimulus space. And in order to do that, we need to be able to learn these posterior distributions. Yes?
To do this, do you need to take into account also the stimulus history of
the word? So we haven't done that here. So in order to do that, what I mean is the fact now that I tried to show you before that we can build a good model for the response of the population for every point in time, I can now use that to try and estimate the posterior over stimulus values, and now I'm playing with the time along the movie and the particular frames in the movie as the different stimuli. So I'm not using any kind of notion over long periods. So basically what I have now is that for every word that we saw in the experiment, I can talk about the probability over stimuli with which it might appear should you show this over and over again. And then I'm going to measure the similarity of these distributions over all the words that I see, and I'm going to get a big matrix, and I need to look at it and hopefully make sense of it. So we computed this, and we ordered so this is what it looks like when you take these matrices and you plot them when you need to decide how you're going to order the words for the matrix. So we did what everybody's intuition goes with, which is the firing rate. So these are just the patterns that have one spike in them, two spikes, and so on and so forth. I think it's clear that there's not much to be seen here. But then if you take this same matrix and say, well, let's just cluster it and just do k-means, because this, just to show you, this works with stupid things. You don't even need to be smart about this. This is what the matrix looks like if you reorder things the right way. So again, this is a measure of the semantic similarity of patterns. It's clear already here to some extent, but even clearer for the natural movie, that the words fall into what you can think of as semantic clusters. All these words are very similar in terms of when they're being used and how they point back to the stimulus space. And if you now try to plot them, and it's kind of tricky because the 6,000 patterns here in the projector cannot get to this resolution, of course, but you can get a sense of what's going on, that there is something that makes these blocks similar to one another, but the variance within each semantic group is really big. And if you ask yourself, well, what if I did the most intuitive thing that you're all thinking about, namely the Hamming distance between the patterns, this is the best thing you can do after you use the best, this is the best version we got trying clustering the Hamming distance matrix. There is no block diagonal structure.
Okay, what was the diagram of the bottom shown?
Sorry. So this is, so what I see, I said, what are the, so now that I've ordered them in a way, there's some particular patterns here. These are the patterns that belong to this block here. So you can see that, you know, this is kind of dark and this is kind of dark. So there's something which is common to these patterns, But it's not obviously, and I'll show you more of this in a minute, what makes all these semantically similar in terms of their structure.
Are you going to show us the images corresponding to those patterns?
I'll try and well.
But if you had used cross correlations between these patterns, it would have worked to some extent, right? Except Hamming distance, but correlation.
Hamming distance is a version of cross correlation.
Yeah, but I mean they look correlated, so.
So this is Hamming cross correlation. Doesn't look much better. There's not much structure there.
But they look very correlated. I mean, how come that you cannot get clusters from these?
There, if you look very carefully here, there's some structure here, but it's very fine. This is not as close as I'll show you why in a second. Okay.
Is it the case that other things, that other patterns that are not in that block are also correlated with that block? That might be an explanation for why correlation.
There are, but you know, but this is you know.
Is the ordering the same in this slide and the next?
Yes. Sorry, no. This is the best one we got from this. This is trying the best one. This is the best clustering we got for this one.
For the Hamming.
So this is trying to tailor it for the Hamming. We don't get the clusters.
So that metric you just showed, for the diagonal thing, was induced by natural stimuli, right?
Yeah, but you can also see that for the artificial stimuli as well.
Okay, so that's natural artificial. Okay.
Yeah. So what this means is that what we did is let's take the words from this thing and try to see something about the nature of this space. So we try to embed this in some low-dimensional figures to see. And to our surprise, this worked really well. So this is now the trying to put this with LLE or whatever in three dimensions. And so we plot an ellipsoid around all the dots that belong to one of these clusters.
So what are you? So if I take my full distribution, it will have many maxima. Are you just these clusters are individual bumps in the distribution? That's what it is, right?
I'm going to show you. So what we see when we're trying to embed this is that it seems like they really fall nicely into these ellipsoids, which are separated from one another. And we've seen this kind of picture before when we, you know, if you go back to Shannon. Because in order to try and overcome noise in your encoding system, the basic thing you would do is to say, if I know something about the noise in my system, I'll put my code words far enough from one another such that despite the noise, it will be easy for me to decode them. So what we think
is again using data from Fructo.
So this is now retina data again with the natural movies or artificial movies, basically. Mm-hmm. So if you go and try and ask, and so this is now picking some subset of these clusters, so you can try and get a sense of what is the variance between them. So this is kind of a set of these, and this is the average of all these patterns, which to give you a sense that what you get is that this average member of this semantic clusters are. I mean, you see these black bands. This is. I'm using the a bit like gels in the genomics, but these are kind of the patterns that are really appearing, or the neurons that are playing in every one of these patterns. But you see that there are not a lot of really black stripes; there are a lot of grayish ones and white ones, which is going to tell us something about what makes these things. And then we ask, well, so can we learn a simple, intuitive metric for this thing? So something about the linear relations between the patterns with the right set of weights. Nothing approximated this even remotely. We tried bilinear things. We couldn't get anything that even looked close to this structure. So we cannot replicate the big matrix from by any kind of simple syntactic measure of what's going on. They really seem like they're organized in the space in some collection of things. And then you can ask yourself, well, what does this really mean? What are these clusters? So I don't think I have the slide here for the natural movie. This was completely useless. To try and make sense of what's the average stimulus that comes with each of these patterns. For the white noise, it was more sensible to do so, but nothing apparent, nothing clear came out of this in terms of what are these clusters. And so to try and...
Just go back. These clusters just came from the response, you know, your response. It has nothing to do with your random H function, right?
No, this is a different story.
It's a new story, yeah?
Yes, okay. This is the spin-off.
So do you think that the clusters are sparse just because the movies are not long enough?
I don't know, I need to have a longer movie, but let me show you what happened when we went for another movie, which was of the same length, but was not one the one we learned from. So we went for another movie and said, if this is really makes sense, and this is really, the code is built based on these clusters, and they mean something, we can try and see if really what's going on is that the retina, in this case, is coding the movie, almost coding by clusters, let's call it. So we took another part of the movie, but after we've learned what we think are the rules for this, of the structure of these clusters. And then we say, let's take each of the pattern and then just ask which cluster it belongs to, which here I denote by the color of the, just color for the different clusters. This is a cartoon just to, because this is too many spikes, but just to give you a sense of this. And then I'm going to ask how much of the information about the new movie I would retain if I knew the exact structure of the code in the usual estimation of information rates from the binary patterns, blah, 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 versus the case where I just for each of these patterns, I'm just going to retain which cluster it belongs to. Okay? And then ask how much do you know if I just tell you the identity of the cluster that the pattern belonged to. Now, there's a free parameter here, which is how many clusters I'm going to try and organize things into. So we tried all of them and asked, let's see how this behaves as a function of the number of clusters that we're going to play with.
What do you mean you tried all of them?
So we said, well, we can cluster into one cluster, two clusters, three clusters, and up to as many neurons as we have, patterns that we have here. So as a function of the number of clusters that we break things into in the training data, I'm going to ask in the test data, how much do I know about the movie? And so we can ask, in terms of how much do I know about the movie from knowing just the identity of the neural activity versus how much I would know if I had the full table of all the patterns and all the repeats and all that. And what you see is that this fraction goes very quickly, climbs up to be on the order of 90% by the time you have a little over 100 clusters. And this is the best you can do with the Hamming, and because this is logarithmic scale, this means that to get to 90%, you need on the order of 5,000 clusters or so, which is basically means it's a completely different game. So
for how many neurons?
This is for 20 cells. And so since I think we're getting close to cookie time, or already there, I'll just use three more slides and finish up. We try to ask this in a bit of a different way, instead of asking, if you now look at the new movie, if you look at repeats of new movies, do the patterns seem to be coming from one cluster or many clusters? So if you ask over the new kind of stimuli for artificial movie or for natural ones, this is the dominant cases. When you ask how many of the, this is in gray, I'm plotting kind of stimuli for which the same particular pattern repeated many times. So you get some things repeating. But if you ask how many of the patterns at every presentation of this new movie came from the same cluster along the movie, you see that basically a lot of the times you actually get different things coming from the same cluster. It's even more clear looking at the natural movie. And the other way to test this is to say, what if I went to the other movie, took a pattern that I've never seen before, and now I want to ask at which times it might appear in this new movie? So can I predict the posterior over the stimuli for this new word that I haven't seen before just from what I've learned about the structure of the code from the other movie? And the answer, it works pretty well. So this is the one example of this is the new pattern that we found. This is its nearest neighbor in the code book from what we've seen, from what we've learned. And this is the posterior over stimulus values. This is for an artificial stimuli. This is for the natural one. And summing over many, many groups of cells and movies, we can do fairly well in predicting for a new pattern that we've never seen before where it might appear in the other movie.
So then you can train the model on the natural and look at
these. So these are two. No, so we didn't train for the natural and the artificial. This is for two natural movies of the same family. Okay, so I'll just say that part of what this means is that our intuition about what makes the pattern similar is messed up or it's wrong. So the structure to this thing, it has a very clear organization in space. It seems like there's a sparse set of things that govern the code book. So for this 20 cells, there's 100 semantic clusters or so. And then we can say, well, if we can ask this about trying to ask about what makes things similar, maybe we can ask the same thing about the space of stimuli. So we went to one of these experiments where we showed what's called the natural pixel to the retina. So this is now taking one pixel from a natural movie, blowing it up. So this is kind of the light level as a function of time. And then you can ask yourself, here's our two snippets of the movie in time, and ask, how similar are they? And what we all do, just because this is what we're trained to do, is to say, well, I'm going to plot these two waveforms, one on top of the other, and compare them. Which amounts to doing mean squared error between the waveforms of the stimuli. And then the other thing we could do, which is where they said, well, the same way we did this for the patterns, we can say, I'm going to ask whether two stimulus snippets are similar based on the neural responses that they generate at the level of the population. Now, you all know what's coming, which is these two things completely disagree with one another, but it's kind of impressive to see to what extent they disagree. So here are two stimulus segments that are very far in terms of their mean squared error, but they're very close in terms of the overlap in the neural response that you get from them. These are two snippets that have the same mean squared difference between them, but they are completely different from the point of view of the response of the retina. And these are other examples. And this is kind of a summary of all of this. If we go along the movie, this is the axis over here, and at every point along the, if I go back to this thing and I take different times along this movie and I ask, is for different snippets, what's the mean square difference between them, L2, between the waveforms? This is what you get. And this is what you get from asking how similar was the retinal response to this kind of snippet, which tells you that there are a lot of times when the retina basically said, I don't care. These are all the same to me. There are particular stimuli that it really cares about. And if you were to try and estimate things by the overlap of the movies and put them how well you reconstruct them, that would just be wrong. So even in terms of how the retina views the stimulus space, there's a metric, which is not the one we're all used to and trained with. There's a metric to this thing that has rules that we can actually learn. It's just different than what we're used to, and I'm going to skip the how we can actually learn this. So let me sum up. I've tried to argue that the population code of large groups of cells is strongly correlated, and this sits on some sparse set of higher order terms, and we can get a very good picture of the code book from having something on the order n in the case of simple examples I was showing before, or with this random projection models a little bit more of actually capturing the code book at the resolution of individual patterns as well as you can get from doing the experiment again. In terms of the semantic organization, what we get from the retina, and we're looking at the cortex now, is that for these kind of movies, we see that there are semantic organizations that we can understand as kind of clusters. And that there's also a metric that that's kind of gives some kind of a metric organization, which is not the one we usually think about. We can start asking if we can embed this in some weird way, and this is kind of an interesting question by itself. We have the same kind of very non-trivial metric if you even look at how the stimulus space looks like from the point of view of the neurons. And then there was the short introduction to random projection models that I'm happy to tell you about later if you bug me. Thank you.
Yes? This random projection model, can you use it for spatial-temporal?
Yes. And it worked.
I wonder if you can use deep neural networks and see at the earliest layer, introduce some noise, and apply the same kind of analysis.
Deep neural network. I'm just kidding.
No, just apply the same kind of analysis, but basically on the beginning layers of a deep neural network.
Yeah.
And try to see what kind of metric is being learned.
Ah, so you're saying if to train with the neural network to capture the code and then to use that as a way to learn the semantics of the... we haven't tried that. That will be interesting.
Oh, not to learn the semantics, but just to learn what kind of statistics are being...
Deep learning
to learn the semantics of neural network.
Well, one has learned something.
Sorry. let's try again here, and then we'll go with this. So you want to try and so I can train a deep network to capture the statistics of the neurons.
So you take a deep neural network which has already been trained, perhaps on some large data set, data set, and then you apply the analysis that you provide here as if it was your retina.
So I'm trying to convince David that this is worth doing, but he doesn't like me that much. We want to try and do this. Yes?
I had a question. So in distance metric, you had this coefficient something which was DJL.
Yes.
So what is that?
Ah, sorry. I skipped that. This is a cousin of the famous Kullback-Leibler divergence. It's called Jensen-Shannon divergence, and it has the nice properties that it's bounded between 0 and 1. It's symmetric, and its square is a legal metric in the mathematical sense. So it's a kind of a neat thing to measure things by.
Satisfies triangle inequality.
Yeah. So the square of it.
Thank you.
Thank
you.